to BLQ. They paved paradise and put up a parking lot with a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Welcome to the Resiliency Radio Hour. This is DJ Gadget with our awesome host, Katie Kiefer, on Stereo 1230 and 103.1 FM WBLQ. We stream worldwide at WBLQ.net, Westerly's only radio station.
Treasure it, people.
Nailed it.
And now we will call this meeting to order. Love Tuner is back, people. Rejoice.
Yes.
Didn't you miss the Love Tuner? Of course, Dick doesn't know about the Love Tuner.
That's right.
But yes, I mean, for people who have been tuning into this radio program for a while, my best friend sent me a Love Tuner from California. This is it. And it blows the note C, which is supposed to sort of reorganize your brainwaves in some happy, relaxed way.
That's because a pirate's favorite letter is the C.
This is R.
Oh, that was R.
You would think it's R.
We might have to kill all you for that one, girlfriend. Welcome, everybody, to the Resiliency Radio Hour. And today we're going to announce a really fun new collaboration. Some of you may remember that Mark Doherty and Erica Liebling from the Westerly Land Trust joined us a few weeks back. And in the ensuing weeks, we put our heads together and decided that we would actually collaborate on a regular basis. And so about every 6 weeks or so, they're going to come in and talk about what's going on with the Land Trust and what kinds of programs are in the offing and what kinds of projects they've been engaged with. And I'm really happy to have them because, first of all, our rapport was just so good. And secondly, because everybody needs to know, since you're all locally listening, you all need to be involved in your Westerly Land Trust. I mean, if you can't volunteer or donate, at least enjoy the trails and the programs. There's lots of stuff for kids. So that is the goal, is to make the Westerly Land Trust blow up big time with resiliency listeners. But today we have a very special guest with Erica and Mark, and his name is Dick Holliday. And Dick, I hear from Mark that you were like kind of the, maybe the genesis behind the Land Trust. How did you get involved in getting it started? And let's put your microphone kind of close to your face.
Well, thanks, Katie. I was not the genesis, but the Land Trust was born, and it was a bit of a struggle to get it in 1987 by another group, they were friends of mine, but I wasn't involved with. And they fought hard to get the tax status that was...
Right, because it's a 501c3.
And it's off the town tax rolls, too.
Uh-huh.
And that latter category was hard to get, hard to get. But they got it. And they went on from 87, to 97, and they had no land.
Oh.
It was a land trust that was all dressed up for the party, but the party... There was no place
to hold the party.
Yeah.
And about that time, a developer was attempting to develop a farm in Avondale, and I live in Avondale, and that farm is what separated our little village from the developed world. The developer is a long story, which doesn't need to be told now, but the developer ran out of money. There was an auction, and I had this idea then that if we could buy four or five lots that would be down along the backside of our village, it would keep us from the developed world.
Right.
And with a neighbor and very dear friend, Bill McKendry, we sort of put this together, but we needed a tax vehicle.
Yeah.
So I called Harvey Perry, who was the dynamo in the early land trust days, and said, we need to get together because we need your tax status. We've got this idea. And he said, well, it's too bad because we've voted to disband. We have no land.
Oh, my God.
And he said, but Cynthia Lafferty, whom I knew, is a new president. Call her. Yeah. And so I did. And she said, oh, thank heavens. I had not written the check to drain our treasury, which was voted to be written.
Wow, Dick.
So we turned it around. So I was in the genesis of stage two.
Right.
not
and really the most important stage. I mean, it's great to put it together, but then unless you're actually doing conservation work and preserving property, it's not really a land trust. It's more like a community effort or something.
Well, it had some land that was supposed to come to it, and actually since years later it did come in finally from that first phase. But we then got help from Harvey Perry and others in the land trust, and we started to raise money, and we got that Avondale. Thanks to Chuck Royce, who took a great interest, he said, let's do more than the four or five lots that Bill and I had talked about. Let's do the whole thing.
Wow.
And so we have...
Because Chuck can do that.
We created what is the Avondale Farm Preserve, and it's one of our most used preserves. And it really was the kickoff for the program that now has, I guess, 32 properties.
Putting driver in the car, right? Yeah. The car was set up. I like that. The vehicle that is the land trust and the organization. But then plug in the land and you can start rolling down
and
the road.
Start the drive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really fantastic. What were was it the tax status that was the biggest challenge, or was fundraising a real problem? Like, I mean, obviously you had to raise quite a bit of money. I mean, even Chuck has a limit probably to what he's willing to fork out every year. I don't know. Maybe not. But
the tax status that was most difficult. In fact, there's an organization to which we're accredited called LTA, Land Trust
Alliance.
They said that the battle that our predecessors fought back in 1987 with the town government here to get that off the tax roll status. Nobody cared about the 501c3 part.
It's right.
Federal. But the town off the town tax rolls was apparently our town government at the time, and I was not involved, they put up a stiffer fight than any other town, according to LTA at the time.
Right.
So that was the hard-fought battle. Mm. As for raising funds, yes, it's always a challenge, and we're pretty good at it. And I say we. I'm not raising funds for the Land Trust. We haven't for many years.
But, that's a very special job with a very special skill set, in my opinion. I don't think it's easy at all to raise money.
But I do think that you share the story a lot, Dick, and I think that that does help. You know, I think that you go out and you spread the message, and whether you know it or not, I think that you are playing a role. So we appreciate it.
And Erica would know, she's donor relations manager for the Land Trust, right?
Yeah.
So
the reason that I got enthusiastic was all about keeping Westerly as rural as we could. Mm-hmm. Now, others are more interested in the aquifer and
keeping
alien plants out. And there are a lot of other interests that drive the land trust. But my interest was to keep Westerly scenic. You know, Westerly is largely supported, the entire town government is supported by people who can't vote here. They're seasonal residents, and that's our little gold mine. That's what keeps our taxes as low as they are, as high as they are, but they're comparatively low because of this. And you wouldn't get people coming here, bringing money they've made elsewhere to invest in our community, have a lovely home, et cetera, if you developed the town, overdeveloped the town, or developed it wrong.
Right. It's like killing the golden goose, right?
So I think so. So my, I'm not all interested in native plants like Mark is, and the aquifer like a number of people are. I mean, that's good, and it's got to be. But my drive is just to keep it pretty.
Right. Mm-hmm. Did you grow up in this area?
No.
You're a transplant too, right? Yes. Where did you come from?
Western Pennsylvania.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Did you grow up in a rural community?
No, I grew up in a house that was surrounded by woods and farms until I moved away from it in high school, when it was surrounded by houses.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's so important. It's actually easy to care about everything, but it's not easy to be successful when you care about everything. Mm-hmm. And one thing that when I was organizing stuff in college and stuff, like pick an issue or two. Two is a lot to like put yourself into. And I think... your generation is very useful for people who are interested in preserving land and becoming resilient. This is like actual like advice from an older generation. Pick one thing and work as a team. Sure, you like flowers and you like bugs, and I just want the land that they bloom and feed on. You work on that, I'll work on this. And that's like the most successful way I've ever seen anything accomplished is...
Right.
I think in the age of information too, where we all know a little bit about everything, then it gets even harder because things can be overwhelming like that. But we're all only capable of one task at a time. Yeah. Or
it's also
or
how many things do you get angry about? And that takes up a lot of your soul, you know?
Anger.
That takes up lot of your mind. And if you're angry about groundwater and bug hotels and native plants and the land trust and, you know, the fact that there's starving kids in China as well, your brain is everywhere and you're not focused on anything and you're not doing a service to the people.
Mm-hmm.
But
or
if,
to your cause.
Yeah,
right?
Or to your cause or to yourself. That's a lot of stress. That's a lot of gray hair.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-uh.
Gray hair can be beautiful. Look at Katie.
Aww. Look at Dick.
Yeah.
At what
if
hair?
I stopped putting dye in mine,
you've got a few threads left. Yeah.
Full fringe. Right.
Snattering.
That's right. You've got your tongue jauncher there. Your, yeah.
Mark's
your
got enough for everybody.
Yeah, yeah.
You got enough hair for everybody.
And it's curly, too. Like, oh, my God. You should really be a girl, Mark.
Maybe I am.
He's so pretty. I love him.
Let's not go there.
Okay, deal. I agree, Dick.
I wasn't too worried, but, you know. In this day of fluid gender,
yeah,
you know, you could toggle back and forth if you wanted to.
There's something to learn from everybody.
I wish that the people out in the radio world could see the sweater that Mark is wearing today.
That's true.
Why don't we describe it?
It has...
That's quite foul.
Yes. I mean, how many birds? Like, maybe
a
24?
A whole neighborhood.
24? Oh,
are
yes,
they all the local? The local birds?
Yeah,
to
they're your
area?
Backyard birds. We have
cardinals,
a black-capped chickadee, American goldfinch, cardinal, yep, titmouse... Blue jay, who else we got there?
Bluebirds.
Bluebirds as well, yeah. Oh, cedar waxwing.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is a great... So a lot of the guys that we're seeing, except for the goldfinches who have moved on now, but are year-round residents, yeah.
Right.
It belies the old adage that birds of a feather flock together.
They certainly do. They certainly do. I love that. It's good to be at a round table with you guys, so... Yeah.
Go ahead, Mark. What were you going
to
say?
I was going to turn it over to you to lead us into the song.
Yeah, that's what I'm here for.
Yeah.
So, Dick, I'm still going to, like, drill down on you for a little bit. I wondered if you could, you know, since we've just been talking about sort of the older generation leading for the younger generation in terms of stuff like this, what would be your bits of advice to, you know, a group, say, in another community that might want to start an organization like the Land Trust? Like, where do they, you know, you realized that what really needed to happen is A, you needed land, and B, you needed this specific tax abatement. So is that where people should start? Like, how do you motivate? I mean, you motivated a community.
Well,
really.
That was done by the first gang, I think. They weren't able to draw the land in, but they had the cause, and all I did was patch onto that. But I think, you know, there would be two phases. One is to be a leader, and for this group that you asked me about, to be a leader and put together a vision. In other words,
right,
if we could get together and do this, this, and this, think what we could have, or think how it would impact the community and benefit the world.
Right.
But then after you've gotten that local excitement generated and gotten volunteers, that's when you turn to, I think, to LTA, because you mentioned how to get the tax status, how to get this. That's where I think you turn to LTA, and they'll give you advice whether you're accredited or not.
Uh-huh.
But eventually...
I never even knew there was a land trust alliance.
Eventually you will want to be accredited, and it's a big, big job.
Right.
That happened, I think, before either Erica or certainly Mark were involved.
2017 was the original.
But I was not sure when you started, Erica.
Yep.
But it was a terribly big undertaking.
Well, what does that actually
mean? For the board,
mean?
The volunteers, and the employee.
Yeah. What does it really mean to be accredited, though? Like, why do they need that?
Well, I think it all started back when people were taking advantage wrongly of tax donatable land, and it needed to be reined in. And someone thought there needs to be standards. And if you're going to be able to, if you're going to attract people to give land and make it possible for them to get a legitimate tax deduction for that, you start regulating. You have to make sure that the organizations that are seeking this land and taking possession of it are run right. They're run honestly. They run their books right. They have the right policies, and you have to set all this up, and it's pretty rigid, and you have to meet it.
Right.
And then after how many years is it? 5 years or 10? You have to be reaccredited.
Right. So 5 years,
Correct.
For the is it every 5 years or now, or is it, mm-hmm. yeah, okay, every yep. 5 years.
And this is all a voluntary process, you know, that we're going through. So it's something that, but yes, you're right, you're mm-hmm. right. It's not necessarily a requirement, but it's something that we want to be able to, you know, fly that flag and say, you know, we are living by modeled standards and mm-hmm. and conforming to really high standards.
I don't know what the percent is, but of all the land trusts out there in this country, what percent are accredited?
It's a low percent.
Yeah, 30. Yeah.
Jen just mentioned it the other day. Do you remember?
She did. I don't remember it off of the top of my head, but I'm looking for it right now.
Well, so to speak about the Alliance as well, it's a great tool. Their website, talking with their team, it's a great tool for anybody in a land trust organization, whether they're on the stewardship side of things, the donor relations side of things, the leadership side of things. There's so many great tools, and they hold an annual conference where we were able to attend this year. And
Down in New Orleans.
Yeah, it was great.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so good conversation, facilitated by some hurricanes. Yeah. But really, it was so awesome. And I think it was great to put what the Westerly Land Trust is doing into perspective. You know, there are a lot of land trust organizations, say, in Maine or the West that are operating on much larger, you know, conserving 500,000 acres of land. That are being managed for multi-use and doing all this different stuff. And now we have 1,700 acres of land, and we're confined to just here in Westerly, but we are still all coming from the same place and able to, you know, provide services to our community, provide the local environment with an opportunity to remain the way it is. We had a lot more in common with those larger organizations than you would think. And to get together with them, learn and share was great.
That sounds wonderful.
I mean, there are some that are, you know, crossing state borders, mm-hmm. and here we are, and, you know, we're doing work in Westerly. So mm-hmm. it was really interesting to talk to
the
people
scale.
Who, yeah, yeah. And, I mean, Mark came from Colorado, where he was on not at a land trust, but, like, at the grand swaths of land that people are able to deal with and manage. Mm-hmm. It's pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, it's good work all around. And I can tell you now that there are more than 450 accredited land trusts, and it looks like about 1,363 land trusts in general. So 450 of those are accredited.
A third.
Wow, one third. Yeah. So why doesn't everybody seek accreditation then? Because
it's hard work.
Because it's hard work. Yeah.
You have to follow rules. Not everybody wants to do that.
It's a process.
Well, you have to. Once you're accredited, the grooves are set. You stay in those as far as policy, procedures, mm-hmm. and appraisal of land and all that kind of thing. But I was going to throw in two other things. You know, we have 1,700 acres in town, which, by the way, is about 5% of the town is in the land trust. But we also, previous generation of volunteers, was facilitated a big acquisition over in Hopkinton. Mm-hmm. And we have a bridge across, so our trails join with their trails. And that was initiated by the Westerly Land Trust for Hopkinton. We won't cross that river.
Right.
But the other thing that I don't know if it's been covered in other discussions, but we were early and unusual in having what we called an urban initiative.
Mm-hmm.
And we sat at the board when this was proposed and said, well, you know, it was generated basically by Chuck Royce, who said, I think we can do better downtown. And we debated that and said, well, you know, after all, land conservancy, open space conservancy is the flip side of that is to get people not to go out to a cornfield and fill it with houses, but rather to live downtown.
Right.
Make the downtown more attractive, more livable. Place where people want to be close to. And so we set up what we have would then call, I don't know about today, the Urban Initiative.
Right.
And of course, you know, we've got
buildings
around here, United, Knickerbocker, Industrial Bank, and properties down Main Street below the bridge.
The Community Garden.
Community Garden.
It's one of my favorites. It's just a little spot of green on Main Street.
Yeah.
I love driving past it and being there and seeing everybody's produce that they grow right there in town. It's pretty cool.
That is.
Yeah, we've got people who can walk there from their homes. And
they got their little cart with their tools and stuff walking down.
They may not have a yard or a garden at home, so they're able to do it right there on Main Street.
If they were in Argentina, they'd just ride their horse.
Well, because we could bring that back.
People literally have horses in their backyard. If you're not in a city, an urban center, and even if you are in a small town, you have a horse in the backyard. It was unbelievable, people.
That's I have a deer in my backyard.
I got him too.
He won't let a deer. He's beautiful. And
tell Mark.
I won't say where I live now because I'm like, I don't want hunters to come get him. He's beautiful. That would be cool.
That's
I want to ride
what they're
a deer.
Doing. They're literally riding
Santa
their horses
style.
Like over it.
No, I was thinking
like
the deer
down
because
the road
you can
at night and there'd be like
hang the bags right on the antlers.
That's right.
Yeah. Awesome.
Saddlebags.
Yeah.
I'm gonna be Snow White now.
I love it.
Well, that's an interesting aspect of land conservation. And I, like, as I said, I'm from South Kingstown, so I don't think we have an urban initiative in South Kingstown. We don't have a Chuck Royce either, unfortunately. Mm. We have a very robust land trust, and I'm not throwing shade at them by any means. But there's
I think
no
that's
urban initiative, and I think that would be very good for Wakefield because we have had a lot of sort of development depredation, I would call it. I mean, I grew up in that town, so I remember what it looked like when I was a little girl. Mm-hmm. And it ain't looking like that so much now. No. We have Main Street, Robinson Street, like sort of the nice sort of residential areas, all pretty. But the sort of sprawling ghastliness of Dale Carlia Corners and now the, you know, the whole South County Commons thing and like, where's the green space? And we had that beautiful Larchwood Inn that they knocked down because it supposedly could not be repaired. And nothing has been done with that property either. And to me, that would be like my number one go-to if I were in land trust business would be to say, I want that property. Mm-hmm. I want to make that into a community space.
There are beautiful towns on Narragansett Bay where the Gold Coast, you know, beautiful homes, great views, good waterfront. And they've been, by development or misdevelopment, they've been rendered so that nobody from New York wants to bring their money and buy a home in some of these towns. I won't mention names. But it just doesn't happen. But it does happen here.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And as I've said before here, it's a huge part of the financial support of this community.
Right. Mm-hmm. I think, say that about Wakefield, too.
I think it goes back to the fight for the tax abatement from the town in the early days. It's I think that the value of conserved or what maybe some people would call empty land wasn't really quantified. And I think land trusts start to try to attempt to place a value on that. What I don't believe is a lack of, but other people might call that. And I think to see organizations like ours and other neighboring land trusts grow is sort of the virtue signaling of the people in the town and the people who support those organizations to say, well, if we're not going to use the tax roll to assess the value of this land, we'll use our own dollars and put those up to say that this is worth X to the community.
Right. Right. We got to take a short break for a sponsor drop. We're a little bit behind schedule because this was such an interesting discussion.
I was into it. I didn't even know.
I just want to remind people that My Wheeling City's second annual toy drive with New London Fire and Police Departments is happening on the 17th of December from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. There's food, music, face painting, and more. Plus, WBLQ and WWRI will live broadcast with prizes. If you donate, please donate an on-wrap new toy to My Wheeling City on the corner of Broad and Coleman Street in New London.
Took all the trees and put them in a tree museum. And they charged the people a dollar and a half to see them. Just announced, Central Auto Group in Plainfield has 0% financing on new cars, plus $500 rebates.
Central is your number one buying destination and home of Ford, Mazda, Hyundai, Volkswagen, and pre-owned.
Central has more cars in stock.
Test drive the all-new Ford F-150, Mazda CX-30, Hyundai Tucson, and Volkswagen Tiguan.
At Central Volkswagen, experience the all-new 100% electric ID4. Order yours at MSRP with no additional markups online exclusively at Central Auto.
CentralGroupCT.com.
Dump the car you hate and get top dollar only at Central.
Central always works the hardest to get you approved, regardless of your credit score, and of course at the lowest interest rates.
Why shop anywhere else when you can get Ford, Mazda, Hyundai, Volkswagen, and pre-owned all in one location?
So remember, Central Auto Group in Plainfield has 0% financing on new cars, plus $500 rebates.
CentralAutoGroupCT.com. Exit 28, I-395. Central Auto Group.
When you hear commercials for insurance, you generally hear something like, 10 minutes could save you $100. My name is Dave Woodmansey from Woodmansey Insurance, and I would like you to know that the same $100 you saved in 10 minutes today could cost you thousands of dollars down the road. If your present insurance company did not take the time to properly gather your information and design an insurance package tailored to fit your needs, you may experience severe shortages or gaps in your coverage in the unfortunate event of a loss. And many of you have never had an insurance loss before and don't know what to expect. As a Woodmansey Insurance customer, you can take comfort in the fact that we understand what you are going through and will be there to guide you through the claim process. Our knowledgeable staff will answer your questions, provide advice, and fight for your rights when it comes time for your claim to be settled. For a review of your current coverage needs for your home, auto, business, or life insurance, you can stop in and see us at Woodmansey Insurance. We are located at 1122 Main Street in Wyoming, 539-7000.
BMW of New London. BMW of New London has several new models in stock for immediate delivery. X5s, X3s, X7s, and sedans as well. BMW of New London also has pre-owned vehicles that you can drive away immediately. These are pedigree vehicles from local people just like you. You never have to pay a premium.
New General Manager Wheeler is your dealer.
BMWofNewLondon.com on the corner of Broad and Coleman.
D&V Mechanical offers only the best in cooling and heating, like Mitsubishi Electric's cooling and heating systems that provide individual room control and allergen filtration, all with no ductwork. D&V Mechanical.
You could call D&V Mechanical at 401-741-2704.
This week's savings from McQuaid's. New crop California oranges, 4-pound bag, only $3.99 each. 5-ounce cans of chicken of the sea, solid white tuna. Special buy at just 99 cents, limit of 5 per person. And bone-in assorted pork chops, country-style spare ribs, or pork roast, only $1.79 a pound. 28-ounce cans of Hunt's tomatoes, just 2 for $3. And don't miss the holiday shrimp sale now going on at McQuaid's. Raw or cooked, all at special savings. McQuaid's Marketplace, Main Street and Westerly, and Clara Drive in Mystic.
Harvey Wanda, Mark Rosenthal. Here's your stereo 1230 WBLQ Southern Rhode Island and Eastern Connecticut weather forecast.
On this Thursday, a mixture of sun clouds, breezy and really not cold for December, folks. Temps about 52. Clearing and colder overnight, lows near freezing. Tomorrow, sun clouds, temperatures mostly in the 40s. The weekend, a feature of variable clouds, sun. It'll be breezy and cool near 40. Then we're watching a storm for late Sunday and Monday. It might bring us a touch of rain or wet snow. Certainly stay tuned. From the WBLQ at the Center, I'm Mark Rosenthal.
WBLQ.
This is the Resiliency Radio Hour. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. I'm talking with the Westerly Land Trust. Mark Doherty, Erica Liebling, and Dick Holliday has joined us to talk about sort of the early stages of developing the Land Trust into the mighty powerhouse that it is today.
And I feel like you guys should have rings and like put them all together.
Yeah, yeah.
And like,
I know.
There'd be a lot of rings.
I'm the love tuner.
There you go.
This is a meeting of the minds, people.
I have to tell you that I was lucky enough to go on a hike the other day with Dick Holliday, and I think everybody should do that at one point. Go on a Westerly Land Trust property with Dick Holliday.
Are you you're still volunteering with the Land Trust, right? Yes, are you still involved?
And I should say it wasn't a hike. It was a work. We were out there to work. It was part of the CCC, which Dick can talk more about, or Mark, but that's our volunteer group.
Coffee
I already messed
and
it up. Thank you.
Yeah.
Coffee and Clearing Club.
And clearing. Coffee
there
and Clearing Club. I knew something like that.
And we went out. He took me to Dr. John. Nope. I messed it up again. Dr. Lewis Pond. Yeah. There we go. And I had never been before. sadly, in the 4 years that I've worked with the Land Trust, and it was a delight.
His CCC cap, people. And Dick Holliday has a beautiful cap with the Westerly Land Trust on it, founded in 1987.
And look how
And then on the back, it has CCC for the Coffee and Clearing Club.
I love how corporations will go on like this really $500 dinner with drinks, and they'll be like, it wasn't dinner, it was a working relationship. And the Westerly Land Trust is like, we went on a hike, but it wasn't, I had no fun. We were working. I went on a hike.
I had clippers in my hand.
I had clippers.
I am absolutely enchanted by this thing that I keep seeing on Facebook called the Saker Saw. Has anybody seen that?
No.
It's a little handheld chainsaw with about a 6-inch blade, and it weighs like 2 pounds.
Okay.
And you can literally like put it in a holster and sling it off your belt. I mean, it would be critical.
Like pruning.
Yes. I'm getting, I have alligator loppers, which are cool, but this looked actually a slightly more sort of user-friendly to me.
Nice.
Not to give it a free plug on the air or anything, but wow, if it works as well
we'll
as it looks like it does, a great tool for
You'll have to get one and try it out.
Who has any kind of, you know, property management to take care of. So let's talk a little bit about what's, first of all, you guys put out a great newsletter. I read the newsletter, of course. There was a lot of really interesting projects that we hadn't talked about when you were here the last time. And so one of the ones that really struck me was the Wahinita Pond dredging, which was like a small pond that had filled in with sediment. Like, talk a little bit about what that involved, because I mean, couldn't have been cheap for one thing, because you got to get a backhoe in there, you got to get people clearing the trees and the plants out of there so you can do the dredging. What was the goal of that? Like, why did you feel like that needed to happen?
So you're right. It was not a simple project, and I came in the later stages of it, but I think it had been 5 or 6 years coming. Versus, you know, first of all, like the coming up with the project. So a little background on the space. Back in the day, there was a dam built to hold the pond back so they could harness the power of the running water for a sawmill. And then later on, as the sawmill went away and the pond continued to shrink as parts of the dam were breached, it was still a nice pond for the Girl Scouts to use and kind of recreate and swim. Yeah, there was lots of stories of swimming and fishing and all that stuff.
It looked really tiny to me.
Yeah, the pond used to be, so if you come on a hike with us and we can show you the original extent. It's still tiny, yeah. But it was about to disappear and basically turn into a wetland. And we don't mind wetlands, but we thought that for historical conservation and also, you know, there's dwindling open water habitat over the, 300 years that this pond existed, I think a lot of animals and creatures came to depend on that little pocket of open water in the woodland. We don't see too many of that. So we decided that ecologically that was important. Historically, it was important to kind of demonstrate the dam and continue the educational use like the Girl Scouts did. So the permitting process was, I think, 4 or 5 years, a huge obstacle there. But we're able to come up with a plan that everybody liked and execute.
Everybody being the town council, like who do you have?
The state, Rhode Island Department of Environmental Management.
DEM, yep. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm just curious, like, why would that even be an issue? Because you own that property.
Right.
I'll let you handle that.
Yeah, certainly. But I think that...
I mean, I'm just curious. Like, DEM, this is your property. Why can't you dredge your pond if you feel like it?
Right. So I think it's a little it's a little simpler for folks with agricultural use, right? Say you have cattle and you need a pond for their drinking water. I think there's a different set of rules for that. Mm-hmm. But this property, the state, thinking about aquifers, et cetera, really understands the value of waterways. And I think that's really important, because if everybody just started making ponds everywhere and altering flow downstream, that could affect water on other people's property and ultimately the public water supply. And that's not even touching on the ecological side of things. So while we were enhancing, the ecology of the area, I think that DEM is rightfully so to be cautious with any changes going on in the wetlands. So
I think that really points out how, a lot of times we think, you know, my property, I can do whatever I want. I'm within this little box without thinking how interconnected, you know, that like nature does not care about property boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we see that a lot, obviously, in our line of work. But how, as Mark pointed out, one thing here can affect something over here and can affect it over there. And I think it's really important to be cognizant of that when you do any work on your land.
Right, right. Very good point. Absolutely. Because water is all connected.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you may not see that, but it is.
It absolutely is. So just a little context, like that stream, we've tried to discover a name for that stream, like in old USGS maps or anything like that. But I haven't seen one myself, but I've heard from other people it was called the Great Brook or something like that. Great Stream, which is funny because it's you know, it is a perennial stream, but it, you know, it doesn't conjure feelings of greatness. But but it depends on your perspective, I guess. So to go back to the project, that pond had been filling in from both upstream sediment and, you know, leaf litter and other organic material over the years. We had had successful wood duck box in there that had 1 to 2 clutches every year for the past, since it was installed. So we know this was like an important little ecosystem. Burr reed grass the shallow water allowed vegetation to grow and choke out the pond in the summer, and then it would kind of return to open water once that vegetation died back in the winter. But that's a nice native grass. So basically the design we came up with was this kidney shape where the main channel of the pond was dredged to 7 or 8 feet. And then we created a sort of artificial floodplain on the north side of the pond to maintain some of that burr reed grass habitat, cover for animals and resting for dragonflies and frogs, and a place to put that wood duck box, and a place for the pond to overflow when it floods in the spring. We took out a lot of organic material from the pond, and were able to remediate that by actually bringing it to the farm at Barlow. I mean, that's some good compost in there. I think that's been a practice that farmers have been using for a long time, dredging out their ponds, especially if ducks are in the pond. I mean, doing their business in there. That's some really valuable stuff. So instead of just, you know, we were able to put that to a good use. And that was something that, you know, was an enhancement of the project, I think, really. It was... not in the original plans, but it was something that we were like, hey, this is we're on the right path, I think. You know, we're doing the right things.
Right. Sounds fascinating.
Yeah, it was great.
So it'll be useful for food.
I'm going to demand a hike with Mr. Holiday over here.
Yeah.
You should.
Yeah.
No, not I would love that. That would be great.
Well, the pond was also the site of our first real bridge.
Yeah.
And that gets into CCC and the construction crew we have, because those guys have done some great work, and nothing any better than that bridge that is over the dam at Juanita.
And to think about how the bridge goes over the dam, right? And to think about the view there and how that it's kind of was the start of the enhancement of that whole area, I think is really great. We have, so just a little more background on the CCC, every Tuesday morning from Labor Day through June, we have a group. Anybody is welcome to join us. We have a cup of coffee at 8:30 together, and then at 8:50, we get our orders to go out, whether it's clearing trails, building bridges. Lately, we've been working. We're going to have a float in the light parade, so we've been working with everybody to build a fun float, which has a bridge on it, which is an homage to our building crew, which is a huge, huge part of the CCC. It's a great group.
Come every on Tuesday out. Morning. Light parade happening? Reminds
Sunday.
Me. Sunday.
Yeah. Sunday, December 11th.
Yeah, the Chamber of Commerce is running it. Yeah, and it right runs, I believe, through downtown.
Okay.
And we have our float, which is a on-the-trail theme. Try to bring a little bit of nature into the downtown with lights, I guess.
Well, you got to have lights.
Yeah.
Got to have some lights. And, And then you have another really interesting project, the water quality monitoring
effort at
Bestuxet Brook. Like, how do you guys come up with these? Like, Dick, you could probably speak to this as well as Mark. Like, what? How do you pinpoint these areas that you want to address? Like, you're working the trails, and you see we need to like pay attention to this, or I see a change in that, or what's the criteria?
Well, the first criteria, I guess, is we tend to focus on only our property.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean that we wouldn't look at some other, but Mastuxet Brook was mentioned, and it's a tiny little stream that was supposed to be a perennial stream, spring-fed from basically the corner of Wells and Franklin streets. And it's completely surrounded by residential and commercial. And at its bottom, even, it's industrial, but mostly commercial properties. But this little tiny stream that enters the river down where Westerly's first settlers were said to come ashore, Mastuxet Cove, it spawns the fish in the spring. I should let Mark talk about the process, but we have spawning trout and stuff, and we've tried to watch that. Because if we can keep that stream flowing and sweet, clean, it's an awfully good test of what you can do with good septic systems and management.
So I think that so the water quality was sort of one of my ideas when I first came to the land trust, but it was a pickup on the feeling that Dick, Harvey Perry, other early founding members of the land trust acknowledge the importance of this greenway there was a vision to maintain the buffer around this brook, and basically I think I saw that vision and said, okay, here's the next step we can take. Okay, we've conserved as much land as we can really in that area. The town holds some conserved land in there as well, and that's the big challenge, actually. I think in we are approaching this sort of climax where it's okay that we can't go out and conserve 500 acres at Grills Preserve or anything like that anymore. There's just not these big swaths of land available. So, but how do we continually steward and grow? I think this water quality program is an attempt to do that.
I wonder I know that in my area in South Kingstown, there are 5 or 6 glacial lakes. Mm-hmm. And URI for years, like over 30 years, has been partnering with some of the residents or owners on those lakefront properties to do water quality monitoring. Yeah.
So we do partner with the Watershed Watch at URI, and they process our samples and do that for us, which is great.
Yeah, I feel like that's one of the most important and revealing tells of how well land is being managed is when you monitor the water quality for chemicals. And it just so happens that yesterday when I was doing my other radio show, I was talking to a guy who's the sustainability officer for one of the largest bottled water companies in the United States, Blue Triton. And not to give them a plug or anything, because I don't really particularly believe in water bottling companies buying up aquifers, but the fact is they do and they have. And I said, so how do you, since many of your brands are spring-fed brands, like how do you protect that? And they engage in enormous conservation efforts, including buying property around their springs and working with towns and communities on monitoring discharge and making sure that it's not just the spring that's clean, but the municipal water system is involved. I mean, it was really a very complex thing. And I was thinking, like, really everyone, should be engaged on some level with this. And there should be a level of sort of public education about the importance of maintaining your basic water quality standards. Because, if you're throwing tons of lawn chemicals on or you're tons of chemicals on your farmland or whatever, and you don't have a management plan for it, that's going to have an impact on pretty much everybody in your community, right?
I'm reminded when talking about water quality, the Land Trust, acquired a lot up at Boom Bridge, just below the bridge, obviously on the westerly side. And it was for Lewis Farm up there. They would put calves in there, small early herd critters. And we got shut down because the cattle were doing what they would do. They were going in to drink the river, and all their product was going into the river.
Right.
So we had to go up there. One of CCC's big jobs was to go up there and put a lot of fence posts in and a lot of barbed wire to keep the critters out of the river. And that meant now that they had to have water. So we had to put in a pump.
Sure.
And I guess a well, and then a pump. and we had all, we had a hell of a time getting that pump to work on demand. Uh-huh. We spent a lot of money on a nose-operated well of water.
To try to train the cattle to
And we never did get it to work. Finally, it was wasted money, and we just got a different arrangement up
there. He's got a hose and a trough.
No, but ultimately, we pump up into this tank.
And they could access that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think that's a great representation of sort of like the synergy that can come from, like you were saying, the with the bottle water company, they work with the town, work with local conservation organizations, and kind of it's a create a win-win-win. I think up at that parcel of land, it was the same. There was a need for space for the cattle. There was a need to enhance water quality. The two people were able to come together and allow a situation that works for everybody.
Right, right. Yeah.
One of our priorities over the years, and it continues, is riverfront. Mm-hmm. We own an awful lot of the riverfront in Westbury.
Yeah.
And, I mean, continuing to touch on water quality and partnerships, the Water Quality Monitoring Program was sponsored and funded by the Woodpocketuck Wild and Rivers Stewardship Council.
Wild and Scenic.
Mm-hmm. So that's been a great partnership too, and they have shown continued support for potential expansion of our monitoring capabilities.
I mean, like you said, Dick, you have a lot of riverfront, so in a way, it would behoove the land trust to be involved in monitoring that water quality all up and down your properties, not just in the odd little brook here.
And promoting access.
That's also why we have that riverfront too. It's not necessarily like we want to monitor it on our property. We want to protect that property along that river. So it's kind of a symbiotic relationship.
Absolutely.
So including
that benefits the town.
Yeah, including our most recent acquisition in Potter Hill, which is about 21.5 acres, the Cottrell Family Preserve.
Oh, right.
Yep. Yeah. So right on the Pawcatuck River. And it's just, another big chunk of land that will be able to kind of serve as a buffer with that river.
Mm-hmm.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Really hard. And what else did we have to talk about? Because we only have a couple minutes left. I did love your little feature in the newsletter. People, you should check out the Westerly Land Trust website if you haven't and read this fall newsletter, because it was really enchanting. So Mark had a little feature. You guys, let's blow a little tune of joy here.
Ready?
Love tuner. We loved the newsletter.
And you can find that an electronic version online.
Yes.
Also on our website.
Yes, or you can sign up. And have it delivered to your mailbox.
Right to your front door.
But you had a little piece on beech trees. Now, I have a lot of beech trees on my property, and I happen to love trees. If I could have an arboretum, I would. And I have some nice specimen trees, but we have a lot of beech trees in the woods around my house. It's mostly an oak forest, but there are beech. And you mentioned a couple of pests that have recently come to inhabit the beech tree population here. And I wondered if you could talk about that, because probably a lot of our listeners have a beech tree or two in their neighborhood or on their property, and they should be looking out for this stuff. I know I will be now.
So there's beech bark disease and a kind of a newer discovered disease, beech leaf disease, which I would encourage everybody. It's a little late to observe this, but personally, last summer I observed almost roughly 80% of beech trees I was seeing to have been affected by the beech leaf disease, which
it's an insect, right?
Yeah, they say it's a nematode that lives in and feeds on the leaves of the beech trees. And what that can do is it limits their photosynthesis capability, will kill leaves, and then the tree has to go and grow new leaves during the growing season, which takes, valuable reserve energy. And over years of multiple defoliations can really hurt the tree.
Wow.
Especially younger trees. That's a mystery. And I think that other organizations, I'll give a shout out to South Kingstown Land Trust. They were experimenting with some, I don't know the compound, but they were experimenting with some preventative measures to try to treat some of their trees to prevent the spread of this nematode. So it's really in the early days.
But if you spot that, people could report it. I imagine DEM is all over this too, because they have a forestry department.
Yeah, yeah. So the beech leaf thing is so new. There's really not a lot of information out there. So anything,
so
I mean,
citizen scientists, get your hats on.
Yeah, yeah. Chat with us. I mean, all you got to do is start a conversation. You know, that's something that I've discovered is you just have to reach out and just ask the right questions, talk to the right people, and who knows what will come of it. You know, it doesn't. There's no. You have to talk to this person, or oh, there's nothing set up yet, so I don't need to say anything. You can always just start the conversation.
I blame the Bradford pear. Bradford pear tree. I blame that
for everything,
and rightly so.
Yeah,
I feel sure that you're
for inflation as well.
Get rid of them all. Yeah.
Do you have a lot in your area?
Yeah. Uh-huh. We actually, I forget where, but somebody, I'll remain nameless, it's fine, but I was like, oh yeah, we just got a whole bunch of trees, and I'm like, I hope they're not Bradford pear, and he was like, they are? And I'm like, well, your point is moot. Yeah.
And he was send you my PowerPoint presentation on why the Bradford pear is the scourge.
I have it in my car. You have another hour?
So what DJ Gadget is touching on is the idea of you know, invasive non-native plants and the detriment they can do. So, you know, beech bark disease was brought in, which it co-evolved in Europe with the European beech. And so now when we brought European beeches over here, otherwise known as copper beeches, which are beautiful, beautiful trees.
I love a copper beech.
Oh, they're lovely.
Don't tell me that those are what brought the disease.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, we can't be mad at these beeches. This is just, or at the pest. You know, that's they just co-evolve with each other. And here is this fungus that finds itself in a new environment and new potential hosts that aren't familiar with it.
And so no defenses.
Exactly. Yeah.
What does it look like? Just quickly, and then we have to go.
The beech bark disease.
Yeah.
So that'll be like cankers and cracking. They'll be white. You can see white speckling on the bark.
Okay.
And eventually that can lead to cankers and cracking and fissures in the bark, which allow further fungal or even other pests to infest and kill the tree.
Yeah. Well, I, as I say, I'm very fond of a beech tree. Mm-hmm. And I'd hate to see that happen.
They're beautiful trees.
Also, they're big-ass trees. Excuse me, but big trees.
Yeah.
And if you have to take one down, that's going to cost you, people.
Certainly. Certainly.
Take care of your trees.
So we have to say goodbye now, unfortunately. This has been great fun. Dick, thank you so much for coming in today. Really appreciate your input.
Pleasure.
Erica and Mark, looking forward to our next adventure.
Oh, it'll be fun.
It's nice to be back, people. Have a great week. We'll see you next week. And thanks to our sponsors. No, no, no. Don't it only seem to go that you don't.